We are still in chapter 37, and this morning I bring you a long and interesting comment from Samson Raphael Hirsch. So we'll work up to this in a second, but Samson Raphael Hirsch was the founder, basically the founder of modern Orthodoxy. He was the creator of the idea of Torah im Derech Eretz, that is, that people should study both Torah and the secular world in order to advance Torah. And even today, there is a split about Hirsch's legacy in the Orthodox community about whether such a thing is possible, which is why Yeshiva University has always been such a controversial institution in the Orthodox community, because some people approve of the idea of studying secular subjects and some don't. And that depends. It's, if you want to know how someone feels in the Orthodox world, you just ask them for their attitude towards Hirsch, and that should tell you. However, he was a very, whether you like or dislike his idea, he was a very interesting and effective commentator on the Torah and a very important personality in Jewish history. And I read something, his Torah commentary on the story that we're studying, that I thought would make an interesting subject for today. So first of all, if you remember, Joseph has told his brothers about his dreams, and they hate him both for that and for the favoritism of his father. And now we come to verse 11. It says, "So his brothers were brought up at him, and his father kept the matter in mind." Okay? And remember, we said that this was one of the reasons possibly why later on Joseph resents his father, because his father clearly notices what's going on and yet still sends him to check on his brothers. So this is Hirsch's comment. "Following the precedent of Sforno, one of the most thoughtful of our commentators, we have to look for an explanation of the events that follow. After all, we do not have to do with a band of robbers and murderers who'd lightly commit murder for the sake of a coat. So why did they do it, essentially? They must have considered the act in itself to be harsh but not wrong. So we must keep our eyes open for the smallest indication which make all of this psychologically explainable." So remember, first of all, that for Hirsch and for anyone like him, the action of the brothers is the action of, after all, the 12 tribes of Israel. And this, it's not a small sin they're committing, right? This is, they're going to murder their brother. And in the end, even though they don't murder him, they resolve to sell him into slavery. So they want to know what possible motivation, he wants to know, what possible motivation. I mean, being angry is one thing, being envious is another, but there's lots of sibling rivalry. It doesn't usually lead to murder. We're told that the bad relationship started with kin'ah, which is jealousy, and then sin'ah, which is hatred, came into it, right? The brothers start off being jealous, but then they move to hatred. They hated him because they believed that they could recognize his thoughts and plans out of his dreams, but they didn't fear him because they didn't believe it would ever be realized. When they first heard his dream about how 12 sheaves bow down to my sheaf, they thought, that's really obnoxious. We hate him. We're jealous of him, but we don't think it's ever going to happen after all, right? It's not that they took his dream seriously or prophetically. They just didn't like him. And we know, by the way, that in mythology in general, when someone dreams something and you try to stop them, in the end, the dream is always realized. So, for example, in Oedipus, when his father discovers that he's going to usurp the throne, when that's prophesied, what does he do? He puts him out into the wilderness to die, and of course he doesn't die. Instead, what happens is he grows up not knowing his parents, which leads him to kill his father and marry his mother exactly as was prophesied. So every attempt to upend the dream ends up confirming it, which is exactly what happens in Joseph's case. If they hadn't sold him into slavery, he wouldn't have gone to Egypt, he wouldn't have been next to the king, they wouldn't have come to him for, so they end up actually being unwitting vehicles of the realization of the dream that they're trying to suppress. But at first, he says, they don't think that this is even possible. But now they heard his last dream, which promised him the highest majesty on earth, and not just the ruling rank in the family circle. Because now he says, you're my father and dead mother will bow down to me, right? So now they think he's not just prophesying that his brother, he's going to rule over his brothers. It sounds like he wants to rule over everyone. And this is the second iteration of the dream. And when they saw how their father took it, because remember it says that Jacob kept the matter in mind. It's very different as a kid when your parents take something seriously, right? If someone says something to you at school, for example, someone says, I'm going to get you, and you come home and your parents say, that's ridiculous. It's not gonna. But if your parent takes it seriously, it scares you. So now Joseph has had a dream, and they see that Jacob kept the matter in mind. So no longer, says Hirsch, can they dismiss it, which is an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that before. What's the brother's reaction to seeing that the father took note of the dream? So now they're scared, since Jacob, after all, has had prophetic dreams. He knows what it is to have a prophetic. Remember, he had the dream with the ladders, and God says, I'll take care of you, and I'll bring you home safely. So now they have a father who knows what it is to prophesy, who knows what it is to dream, and they're worried that his realization of that is going to make it possible for Jacob to realize the dream, or it's going to make it inevitable. Okay. And so they saw how their father took it not as a mere dream, but was pondering over it and thinking of the possibility of it coming true. Their jealousy became hatred, because now they think this guy is going to, in fact, be a ruler in the world. And that's not just jealousy. It's not just that our father likes him best. It's that he's going to be someone important. And right after that, verse 12, what's the next thing that happens? Look at verse 12, says Hirsch. What's the beginning of the verse? V'yelchu echav. What do his brothers do? They go away. Immediately after this dream, his brothers went away. Now, in our translation, it says his brothers had gone. But v'yelchu means walked, right? So according to Hirsch, he breaks it up. And the reason he breaks it up, and he's about to say this, is for those of you who know how to read Torah, okay? Look at the second Hebrew word, if you have it in front of you. V'yelchu echav, that's an etnachta. What does an etnachta signify how would you translate an etnachta into English punctuation if you were going to punctuate it?
Stop.
A stop, right, a semicolon or a period. So what Hirsch is saying is you have to take those two words. The Torah reading is telling us to take those two words as an isolated unit, which means the brothers walked away. Because in the English it says the brothers walked away to pasture lir ot et tzon avihem, to pasture the flock of their father. But Hirsch says there's a reason there's an etnachta under that, because it's telling you that that's also a separate unit. That after hearing the dream and after seeing their father pay attention to the dream, they couldn't stand it anymore, so they left. In other words, says Hirsch, the text itself is telling us gradually, if you pay attention closely, the progression of the brothers' hatred for Joseph. And it doesn't happen all at once. It happens gradually. First, they're jealous. Then they think maybe Joseph's dream is real. Then they see their father pay attention to Joseph's dream, and they can't stand it anymore, so they go away, right? Which is their only alternative, because what else are they supposed to do? And where do they go? Hirsch notes this as well. Significantly, they buy an etnachta, blah, blah, blah. It's been deeply impressed in their minds that the harmony of their rights was threatened by Joseph, and that's why they went away. In other words, Joseph's going to get everything. And that's the harmony of their rights means they're all supposed to get a certain amount of legacy from their father, but he's not only the most favored of the brothers, now he's going to take over the world, and that's not good. Moreover, he says, they went far away. Where did they go?
Shechem,
right, in Shechem, which is the place, where do we know that place from?
The
rape of Dina, okay? And what do? They kill the male inhabitants of that place. In Shechem, it's the last place. Well, I'll let Hirsch tell you. They went to Shechem, which is about 80 kilometers away from Hebron. So what's 80 kilometers? 50 miles, 45 miles, something like that. In other words, it's a long way. That's some walk, right? They didn't just go next door. According to Midrash Rabbah, blah, 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 blah. Oh, great. Well, you can see, if you look in the Hebrew, you can see that the word et has two little dots above it,
yeah.
Right? According to Midrash Rabbah, which is according to Rabbinic Midrash, the et is dotted to indicate that it was only ostentatiously for the sheep, but in reality to shepherd themselves, to preserve their independence, which they believe to be diminished by Jacob's opinion and the future position of Joseph. In other words, they said we're going to pasture, but really they were going to get themselves together, to collect themselves, we would say, right? They translate this in Hirsch as to shepherd themselves. But in other words, they wanted to pull themselves together and figure out what to do about this Joseph, who was threatening to take over everything, including their legacy. It's significant that they went just to Shechem, for Shechem was the place where the feeling of their belonging together was first brought so energetically to the family. It was the last scene of their triumph. Boy, we killed him in Shechem, didn't we? In every sense, right? That's exactly what happened in Shechem. They had done well there, and the people who did well there wasn't Joseph, right? Joseph wasn't involved in that. It was Shimon and Levi. In other words, it was the brothers. The last time that the brothers did well was in Shechem, so they go back to Shechem because that's where they remember being successful. That's where, just for those of you who weren't in the class then, that's where Dina was raped, and the brothers killed the male. They told the male inhabitants of Shechem that if they got circumcised, then he could marry the sister, their sister Dina. They all were circumcised, and after the circumcision, the brothers, led by Shimon and Levi, went in and killed all the men. Okay? Whether that was good, bad, or indifferent to do, we're going to leave aside for a moment, but the point is, what Hirsch is saying is that's the last place where they felt like one unit. So now that the unity of the brothers is being disrupted by Joseph, they instinctively go back to the last place where they all felt comfortable again. There Shimon and Levi had spoken so memorably the words, "Shall you treat our sister like a whore?" Right? Remember when that's what they say about Dina. When Jacob, the father, says, "How could you do this?" And this is really significant. Jacob says, How could you kill all them? And they said, "Are you going to allow our sister to be treated like a whore?" In other words, Jacob, are you going to allow someone to disrupt the unity of the kids by treating our sister badly? And that's what's happening again. So they go back to Shechem because that's where they had solidarity, but this time it's not Dina that Jacob is allowing to break off from the group, it's Joseph that Jacob is breaking off from the group. It's actually, I mean, when I read this, this is a brilliant insight, by a series of insights by Hirsch. If then the whole family stand unitedly together as one man when a single member is threatened from the outside, in other words, if they stood together when Shechem threatened Dina, when there was a threat from the outside, the brothers acted in solidarity, how much more must they stick together when the honesty and honor and independence of the whole is threatened from within by one member? Or so they must have thought. So now remember what the question that Hirsch started with, which is, how is it possible for the brothers to do something so terrible to their own brother? And his answer is, remember what they did when they thought the unity of the family was threatened by someone from the outside? They slaughtered the whole town, right? So now they think the unity is threatened by someone from the inside. And all that is required to restore the unity is to do what? To kill the person who's threatening the unity from the inside. Which is a much more plausible explanation than just they hated their brother and wanted to kill him, right? In fact, what often happens with truly terrible murders is they're in the service of a principle that doesn't appeal to people who are outside of it. I mean, if you asked, for example, the Cambodians or Stalin or Hitler or any of the worst murderers, why did you murder? They wouldn't just say, because I hate. They would always enunciate a principle. You know, we did it to, you remember what Lenin said, that to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs, right? The idea was to make a perfect society, you have to kill some people. But the idea of killing those people wasn't just, he would say, because he likes to kill people, it was because he has this principle, and that's what's important. Well, the brothers are enunciating a principle, the unity of the family. And the unity of the family, if you have to break some eggs, so you have to break some eggs, that's just what's required. That's what Hirsch is saying, right? And the worst things that people do, they always have a justification for. Always, right? Whenever someone tells you a story, this is one of the advantages or disadvantages of being a rabbi. When someone tells you a terrible story about what someone else did, you can be sure that if you have that other person in your office, they'll make it sound plausible. It's very rare that someone tells me even the most terrible story and the other person comes in and says, yeah, I just did a terrible thing. No, I mean, there's always a perspective that makes it from the outside sound as though, and in some ways, I must say, the worse the person, the better they are at justifying. And that's true because if they weren't so good at justifying, they wouldn't have been able to get that far in their worstness. It's really true. And so people who do what you think are clearly awful things, if you talk to them long enough, you can be seduced into thinking that it's plausible. And Hirsch is showing us that in the brothers' minds, what they're doing is really plausible. They're trying to preserve the unity of the family. The family, after all, I mean, God promises to the corporate Israel. God doesn't give the promise to Joseph, right? God gives the promise to the people. So Joseph is disrupting the unity of the people. So really, they're preserving God's promise. You can see how this would work in their minds. All they have to do is get rid of Joseph. Yes, it will be painful for Jacob, but in fact, they're doing it for Jacob, even though he doesn't know it, because Jacob is being misled by his love for Joseph. So he goes on. And therefore, they've gone to Shechem, the place of fraternity, where they get engagement and incentive for what seemed to them the necessity for a similar decision, right? The same kind of decision they made in Shechem, they have to do again. And their future would really have been threatened if Joseph's position was what they imagined and feared. And now he has an actually brilliant twist. He talks about the fact, I'm not going to go through, there's a middle section that we don't have to go through, but basically he talks about how in the ancient world, the model of tyranny was one person. It was a king, right? And in fact, the Torah warns against the Israelites having a king, because the Torah knows that when you have a king, you have a tyranny. And through most of history, tyranny was not exercised by a group, although it happened sometimes. It was usually exercised by an individual, right? So it says, they look around and they see how the worst tyrannies in the ancient world are all tyrannies of nations that are ruled by an evil king. Okay? It's just in contrast to such dictatorship, where inhabitants were considered as bricks for building up fame and ambition of a single dynasty, that the family of Abraham was to be the realization of human society on the basis of freedom and equality, where the value of every human being is recognized, where the common mission of tzedek and mishpat and so on is expressed, where God alone is to have the dictating rule over everybody. In other words, says Hirsch, the reason that the Jewish people came into the world was to break the idea of a single person who could ever be a dictator. Because no human being gets godlike status. And in fact, Jonathan Sachs, in a really interesting comment, asks, why Israel? Why is, at least if it's going to ring, it's nice music. Why Israel? He says, of all the lands that God could have given, why does God choose Israel? And his answer is that from the land of Israel, it is impossible to build an empire. He says the geography just doesn't make it possible. You can't build an empire from Israel. You can build an empire from lands from which you can easily invade the surrounding area, but that's not Israel, right? It's very hard. First of all, on borders you have water, and then to the north and the south you have natural boundaries, and you just can't. Egypt could be an empire. Israel's never going to be an empire. And what God was saying is an anti-imperialist statement by bringing his chosen people to a place from which they can't build an empire. And Hirsch is kind of saying the same thing. He's saying that the brothers understand that the whole mission of Israel is to ensure that you don't have a dictator. And so the brothers think Joseph, I mean, you can see the next step, they think Joseph is setting himself up not just to be the most important brother, but to be the dictator of the world. And that they know to be a bad thing, because that's the whole legacy of Israel. That's why you choose a people and not a person, okay? What would become of the future and the future of the whole world if they were to allow themselves to be enchained by the ambition of a single individual? It's a remarkable fact that years later, after the death of Solomon, when the people first wanted to impose conditions on Rehoboam and keep their independence by making him come to terms with them, they again gathered in Shechem, right? This is in the book of Malachim, in the book of Kings, there to raise opposition to the misuse of the power of royalty, Shmuel and Malachim, of feelings of union and equality and all belonging to God. The occurrence here seems on a small scale to be something similar. So now he's recast what the brothers are doing in a completely different way. That is, all of this is actually about the brothers trying to do something noble. They're trying to prevent Joseph from taking over the world. And even though that seems ridiculously implausible, the truth is he comes very close. Because Egypt is, after all, the capital of the world, essentially, in that time, right? And the most important and powerful country in the world. And Joseph does become next to Pharaoh in Egypt. And by the way, their analysis, if you wanted to spin it out, and I don't think Hirsch does, but I'll have to look later. Remember that Joseph is ruthless in his, later on, in the way that he shepherds and distributes food to the Egyptians. He controls who eats and who doesn't. So they're not entirely wrong in their assumption about what Joseph is and is going to become. And for the brothers, Joseph shows no signs, at least in what we read, of being a benevolent dictator. He's egotistical, he's beloved, he's pampered. Who thinks that he's going to be the kind of ruler that Israel suggests? And so from lots of different sides, at least Hirsch gives a brilliant read on what it is that the brothers might think as they go off to Shechem and Joseph then shows up. Because as we'll see, it's not as though they bring Joseph with them to kill him, right? They go off to Shechem in order to collect themselves and figure out what to do. And as they're doing this and nurturing their resentment and talking about their grudges, all of a sudden Joseph comes along. They didn't send for him. The father sent them. And I suppose it's not completely impossible, given Hirsch's reading. It's implausible, but it's not completely impossible that they might think that the father sent them so that they could deal with Joseph. Although they do know that Jacob loves Joseph, so it's probably not the likeliest scenario. But maybe they just think, you know, God is providing them with this opportunity to take care of what they need to take care of. And in a weird way, they're right, although not the way they think. Right? God is providing them with an opportunity to take care of what they need to take care of. But what they need to take care of is getting Joseph down to Egypt. What they think they're taking care of course, is getting Joseph out of the way. Now, let's just take a look at the second dream, which we haven't read in detail, and then we'll take questions and comments. Okay. It says, verse 5. Once Joseph had a dream which he told the brothers, and they hated him even more. Here, the dream which I've dreamed. We were binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly my sheaf stood up and remained upright. Your sheaves gathered around and bowed low to my sheaf. His brothers answered, do you mean, this is verse 5, chapter 37. Now I'm on verse 8. His brothers answered, do you mean to reign over us? Do you mean to rule over us? And they hated him even more for the talk about his dreams. Sarna's comment on this is, the dream was recognized to be inseparable from the personality of the dreamer, reflecting his own needs and wishes. Joseph bore, in the eyes of his brothers, a measure of responsibility for his highly egocentric vision of superiority and lordship. He dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers. Now, this is, I think, you know, when you read Joseph's personality and you wonder, is he culpable? This is where he's culpable. Because his brothers answered him means that he heard what his brothers said. When he says to them, this is the sheaf dream that I had, and they say, do you mean to lord over us? There's no way for him to not understand that they resent and are afraid and angry about his dream, right? There's just no way. And yet, when he has the same dream in a more extravagant way, as we'll see in a second, and he chooses to tell them again, okay? So, he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers. Now, this is where Hirsch gets the idea that he wants, that he's going to control the world, right? Because it's not only the sheaves that bow down to him now. What is it? It's the sun and the moon and the stars, right? So all of Hirsch's reading that we just talked about, that they're afraid that Joseph wants to take over the world, it's because the universe bows down to him in the second dream, which does sound like a megalomaniac, right? I mean, if really, if one of your children came to you, honestly, think about this for a minute. A 17-year-old came to you and said, I had a dream that the sun and the moon and the stars all bowed down to me. What would you do? You would probably take them to a good therapist, right? I would think. Do any of you read Jonah Lehrer? This was a very interesting, yesterday, speaking of therapy. Jonah Lehrer is a guy that we've had here. He's a brilliant young man. He's like 28, 29. He spoke here once. He's written a couple of books. He was at that Mexico debate, and he has a blog that he writes about every day, and this one was about depression and therapy. And it talked about the fact that they've now done longitudinal studies, and talk therapy provides a better long-term solution for depression than pills, because when you go off the pills, your brain chemistry returns to what it was. And to make lasting changes in your brain chemistry is longer and harder than taking a pill, which I thought was a really interesting thing. And in some ways, I must say, as a rabbi, it sort of gave me hope for human beings, right? It's not just, oh, you can take a pill and change, but change is actually hard and requires work and can be done, but, you know, it's not, anyway, so when I said take a kid to therapy, it just reminded me. And this time, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. And he told it to his father and brothers. Now, last time, he didn't tell it to his father and brothers, right? He told it to his brothers. Why this time does he tell it to his father? So one possibility is because his father's in it. And last time, he wasn't. Another possibility is he wants to shield himself from the reaction of his brothers, because he knows that his brothers were upset about the dream. So now he wants them to see in front of his father, and maybe he thinks, well, my father will tell them how my dreams are really plausible and true, because after all, he loves me. But again, it shows a really, you could read it as an ego wildly out of control. Not to have it, but to tell it, because you could see his telling his father. That makes sense. Right? To pull his father aside and say, look, I had this other dream and I had this dream. Because his father's someone who actually might help him understand what the dreams are. His father dreamed, right? So that makes sense to tell us. But to tell his brothers again is not nice and not smart, and suggests something about him that is not in alignment. What his father said to him is, this dream you've dreamed. Are we to come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow low to you to the ground? So his brothers were brought up at him. So here is interpretive. It says va, which could be and as well. But the brothers additionally may have felt justified in their resentment of Joseph, because the person that loved Joseph most in the world also was afraid of this dream. Right? And again, it goes back to Hirsch's interpretation. They might have thought he really does want to take over the world. Even Dad is afraid of him or resents him. And you know how much Dad loves him? He gave him the coat. You can hear the plausibility of this dialogue, given Hirsch's background interpretation, that they're afraid of that Joseph is going to ruin the mission of Israel. You can imagine that the brothers might have had this high-minded justification for killing their brother. The only way to save the mission of Israel and the only way to save our father is to kill Joseph. And that's clear from what our father said. And then it says, you know, the father kept the matter in mind. The last twist that I want to offer to this is that in both cases, when the brothers say to him, do you mean to rule over us? And the father says to him, do you think we're going to bow low to the ground to you? Joseph doesn't say anything. He neither says yes, which would be really outrageous, but he doesn't say no. He doesn't say no, that's not what the dream means. It's the guys at school, that's who. He doesn't say no. And shtika tohoda'a damya, the Talmud says, which it also is a saying in English, silence means consent. if someone says something and you don't, especially if it's a charge against you and you don't answer it, it must mean that you agree. So when the brothers say, do you mean for us to rule over you? And the father says, do you mean for me to bow down? And Joseph doesn't say no. Again, I mean, the Torah doesn't spell this stuff out, but you have to sort of imagine the scene in your mind. And you know that if Joseph denied it, that would be important enough for it to be in the story, right? That would be important enough. But Joseph doesn't deny it. In fact, Joseph doesn't say anything other than I had this dream. Now, it may be because, and I'm not saying this facetiously, I mean this literally, it may be because Joseph doesn't want to lie. It is what he thinks. It is what he believes, the message that he's received, and he's not going to lie to his father and to his brothers, but he also doesn't want to confirm it, so he just keeps quiet. But he should have kept quiet before the second dream, because that was obviously when all of the machinery of his tragedy was set into motion. And there is this, there's this graph to the story almost that you can see where Joseph starts off very high. And by the way, one of the things that the Midrash says, you know, we talked about the fact that Joseph looked like Jacob, but there is also a Midrash that actually he looked like Rachel, that he looked like his mother, and that that was the beginning of the resentment of the brothers. It was every time they saw him, they remembered the mother who was loved more than their own mother, right? And so it could work either way, you can imagine. But so Joseph starts off high, and then he elevates himself more with his dreams. And then there's a gradual descent. First he descends into the pit, and then he descends into jail, and only then does he rise again to Pharaoh's, to being second to Pharaoh. But there is also a graph to the dreams, which is the sheaves, and then the sun and moon and the stars. And it's hard to imagine a more grandiose dream than the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down to you, right? It really is. I mean, if you were going to write a story in which you wanted to give a hero a megalomaniacal dream, you couldn't do better. I mean, other than God bowing down to him, this is as big as you can get. And so you can imagine how it sounds in the ears of brothers that already don't like him. And Hirsch, I think, makes a good case that what they really were afraid of was not that Joseph was an egotistical idiot, but that Joseph was a dangerous tyrant, right? It's plausible, after all. And remember that they lived in a world in which tyrants weren't so far away, right? One of the advantages, and by that I mean, one of the advantages of traveling to Israel is that it is impossible, no matter how much you think you can, it's impossible to understand the smallness of distances in Israel unless you go there. You think you can. Someone says, oh, Jordan is like, you know, the Sterling. Right, exactly. Or Beverly Hills is Syria. And so you think you understand, distance. But you don't really understand until you actually stand there, and look and see that Jordan really is right there. Oh my God, I can't believe it. And the Golan Heights that the Syrians had, they're right in front of me. And so it really is impossible to understand that. And they live in the ancient world, where the king is literally next door. So when you say, how could they imagine Joseph, who grew up in their house, could be a tyrant? It's because the distances were very different. And a tyrant could grow up in your house. And the kid, you know, that you saw as a shepherd yesterday could, in fact, grow up to be the king of the neighboring tribe. And it wasn't so far away. And we live in a really anomalous historical situation where we think of things as very far away from ourselves. Not so much here, but when you, even in Los Angeles, but especially in most of the country, when you see someone famous, it's almost like a visitation from another world. You know, it's inconceivable that such a person is all of a sudden in the supermarket. But But for most of history, you know, I mean, it was still amazing when the king came to town, but still the idea that distances were not so far away. Okay, so let's stop there and take questions and comments on anything we've covered so far.
There's something that bothers me. It seems to be missing. What is Joseph's reaction when he's thrown down the pit, when he's sold to the Midianites?
Right.
You think he's screaming and yelling, you know, how could you do this to me?
Yes.
You're going to get your dues for this?
Right.
Nothing. It's just silence.
No. It's true, and we'll talk more about it as we go along. But Joseph is silent through the whole series of tragedies that befall him. And when he does open his mouth, he almost always invokes God, which is one of the reasons why he's called Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph the Righteous, because he doesn't complain and he does talk about God when he speaks. And this is, but why he doesn't speak, I don't know. The analogy, we'll talk more about it and we'll read different interpretations of why, but one of the analogies that strikes me, which is a very powerful one, is with Aharon, with Aaron. Do you remember what happens when Aaron's children are killed? It says, Vayidom Aharon, and Aaron was silent, right? So it could be that the silence is more powerful than the screaming. There is, and I'm trying to remember which rabbi. It's not Hananya, I don't think. I'll have to look it up. But there is a rabbi who is tortured by the Romans and is silent. And God says, if you cry out, I'll destroy the world. And he doesn't cry out. And Elie Wiesel has a beautiful passage about it, about how the rabbi, by keeping silent, saved the world. But there is something sometimes more powerful in silence than even in crying out. So, yeah.
The dots over et. It seems like a stretch.
The dots are?
The dots over et.
Oh, over et, yeah.
You don't see things like that very often in Torah.
No, you see them a few times, not that often, right.
And the interpretation you gave sounded like a little bit of a stretch. Are there other interpretations of it?
Sure there are, although this one fits Hirsch. This one is from the Midrash. I don't know what others, and I don't think they have anything in
There's
here.
And then you can
look in your own and see if you have it. It's in verse 12,
no,
37, verse 12. No, it isn't in there. I don't know. The asterisk is to the Hebrew at the bottom, which says Nikud al et. It just tells you that there are dots on the et. What is that?
The word et has dots above it to denote that they went only to feed themselves.
They went only, right. So Arashi's quoting from the Midrash, which is the interpretation that Hirsch is using. But I don't know if there are others. Yeah.
I wonder if there's any thought that the dream could have been about something more global. Instead of this automatic interpretation that just means your brothers and your parents are going to bow down to you, that maybe it has to do with other people or other people's gods will bow down to our God.
It's a nice interpretation, the idea that Joseph's dream means that other people will bow down to our God. But the reason that it doesn't track is because at the end of the story, the dream's realized. So since at the end, the father and brothers do bow down because he's next to Pharaoh in Egypt, it's hard to say that the dream doesn't mean that, even though in theory, globally, it could have the other meaning too, but it doesn't not mean that. So, yeah. Jerry?
This reminds me a little bit of the story of, I think, with Henry II and Becket.
Yeah.
Where, in effect, Henry says, this priest is...
Well, no one rid me of this meddlesome priest.
And,
yes.
And the next thing that happens, of course, is they do.
Right.
And then he reacts, how could he do
right.
this?
Yeah, so...
One wonders if maybe Joseph, rather Jacob's unhappiness throughout the rest of is premised on the fact that he was perhaps, in a sense, like Henry, really the moving force that brought this about.
It is possible. Henry II, right, and Becket. Becket and Henry grew up together and were close, and then this is like a little, it's also a great movie, but it's also an interesting side note in English history and in medieval history. It was very important. that Henry wanted control over the church and Becket refused to give it to him. Becket felt like Henry elevated Becket to the top position in the English church, and as a result, Becket felt like he had a responsibility to God instead of Henry. And Henry was upset about that because he, after all, gave him the position. And, you know, you're not supposed to turn around and take your position seriously. And Henry at one point says, and nobody knows whether he intended this or not, he says to his henchmen, who are sometimes depicted as, you know, sort of brainless lugs, will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest? So they take that as a cue that they're supposed to rid him of this meddlesome priest. And while he's clinging to the church altar, they stab him and kill him. And he becomes a martyr and undoes Henry in some ways. Henry, who was one of the great kings of England, undoes him to a certain extent and becomes his most prominent legacy. But nobody knows whether Henry meant it or not. Did he really want them to kill him, or was he just letting off steam, which is a dangerous thing to do when you're a king? And could be the same thing here. I mean, maybe Jacob is just sending Joseph, as we'll come to next time, maybe he's just sending him to check on his brothers, but it does seem like at least his subconscious is putting him in harm's way because he knows that his brothers don't like him. Yeah.
Does this story try to tell us that disasters could be a blessing?
Yes. I think that that's undoubtedly true, that the story is trying to tell us that terrible things can be a blessing. And the reason I say that I think that that's true is not only because it proves to be true in the story, but because this is one of the rabbi's favorite themes. The rabbis are always telling stories about how things that seem to be terrible turn out to be great. And I have to say that even today, if you read very traditional sources, right, you get these stories all the time. And I'm kind of allergic to those kinds of stories. Because what you'll get is, and I mean, everybody involved understands this, but you'll read sometimes, for example, there's a book by Pesach Schindler called Hasidic Responses to the Holocaust, all right? And many of those responses are that this rabbi went to put on tefillin, and because he moved to the back of the tent to put on his tefillin, everybody else was killed and he was saved. Right? And I'm parodying, but you get a lot of stories like that. And you understand the intent behind the story. It's to show that, in fact, piety can save you and that there are miraculous deliverances. And I don't want to belittle the intent. The problem is, of course, first of all, everybody else who gets killed because they didn't put on tefillin that morning. But all the people who put on tefillin and did get killed. And all the terrible things that happened that actually turn out to be terrible. So nonetheless, having said that, who among us doesn't respond to that kind of story? I mean, we all do. The truth is, if there's a plane crash and a child survives, we're all filled with gratitude that the child survives. And whether we think it is or not, we say, look how miraculous that this child survived. Because we have a deep need for a redemptive part of the story, something that turns out to be good out of something that's bad. So, yeah, I think it's certainly true, and I also think, by the way, that it's part of storytelling. That's just part of storytelling, whether it's Little Red Riding Hood or the story of Joseph, something that seems to be bad and turns out to be good in the end, that's why we tell stories. Yeah.
Did Joseph feel that his dream was divinely inspired like Jacob did?
Don't know. Doesn't say. Doesn't say whether Joseph felt that his dream was divinely inspired, but I think the assumption of the commentators is that he felt that, especially because he had the dream twice, which according to the rabbis is an indication of divine inspiration. Yeah?
I have two things to say. They usually have a saying, no pain, no gain, no
right.
gain.
Right, no pain, no gain, yes.
So, but then the other thing is, I don't think Joseph was aware that his dream was a prophecy from God, because it was not only fulfilled in his life, but it had a relevance later on, much later on in life.
So you think he was aware or was not aware? You think it was not aware because even though it came in some way in his life, he didn't see the realization of it later.
No.
Right. Directly behind you.
Related to that, actually, I was going to say, I find it really interesting since Rachel was already dead, and the fact that Joseph dreams the sun and the moon, and then
right.
Jacob says, you mean your mother and I.
Yes. So there's a lot of commentary about that. I'm glad you brought that up. We mentioned it before, but we didn't talk about it. And I'll bring you some more next time. There's a lot of commentary about why Jacob dreams, A, why Jacob dreams about his dead mother, and B, why Joseph, and why Jacob refers to it as, and he doesn't say something like, your mother isn't even alive. So one possibility is that she is alive to him. Another possibility is that Joseph is the embodiment of her, so she's alive to him through Joseph. And the third possibility, which seems to me to be the most plausible, is that it's one of the ways that the story is telling us just how, well, there's a fourth possibility too, which I'll get to. That Joseph is telling us how egotistical Joseph is, that even his dead mother is bowing down to him. But the last possibility is that maybe it's hinting at Joseph's pain, right? That he's resurrecting his mother in his imagination because it's so difficult for him to think of her as gone. You know why? I've repeated this several times because it struck me as so phenomenally wonderful and brilliant. I was reading Saul Bellow's letters, that just came out. And in one of them, I wish I could quote it exactly, and maybe I'll get you the exact quote, but when he loses, I think it's his father, he says that losing a parent is like driving into a plate glass window. At first you don't see it, right? And then you pick up the shards for many years to come. And Joseph, remember, was a kid when his mother died. So it really is an invisible wound. You don't know what it is when you're a little kid to lose a parent. But it affects you forever and ever and ever and ever. And maybe this is the text's very subtle way of reminding us that, remember, Joseph is a child who's growing up without a mother. And maybe some of his megalomania is a result of the others have their mother, right? And also, I have to say that it is not in the nature of most kids, especially boys, to sympathize with the fact that some other kid doesn't have a mother, right? That's not something that boys are going to naturally understand if they haven't gone through it. So you can imagine that the brothers don't say, well, look, lay off Joseph, after all, he doesn't have his mother, since they hated his mother anyway, because she was loved better than their own mother. So there's a lot, I mean, very complicated psychological dynamics going on here. Let me just get to two, Abin. One, two, three. Yes?
What does Vayeshev mean?
Vayeshev means and he sat, or and he dwelt. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts or is there any commentary about how to mitigate in general arrogance with fairness, in that it takes a certain amount of arrogance to go against?
Right. Yeah. It's true. I mean, you don't want someone who's not confident. There's a lot of commentary on it. My favorite brief comment, though, is that the rabbis ask, why did God give the Torah on Sinai? Because Sinai's a small mountain compared to other mountains. And their answer is because of humility, right? He wanted to teach humility, that you don't have to be a huge mountain. And so a later commentary, I don't remember if it was the Kotzker Rebbe, said, if that's true, he wants to teach humility, why doesn't he give it in a valley? Why choose a mountain at all, right? And his answer is because for a valley to think of itself as a valley is not humble. To be a mountain and think of yourself as small, that's humility. In other words, you have to be something to be able to be humble. And you can't be humble if you're a valley, right? So first you have to realize that you're a mountain and then be humble. And that's why God chose a place that is exalted and deliberately made it humble, which is kind of a nice, yeah. That's a great question. I don't know the answer. He said, when Joseph was in jail, did he think to himself, well, that dream was wrong? It's a wonderful question. Or did he think, as I think we're as you would, that this is just, it's a way station. I'm on my way up. And I would say that look, people who, if you read, for example, like Churchill, who had many failures in his life and was dogged by depression, by the way, called it his black dog. He had depression his whole life. And at one point, he finds himself in the hospital. He's just lost an election. right? And he got acute appendicitis. And someone came to see him who said it was the most depressed that they ever saw him. And he said, in the twinkle of an eye, I found myself without a seat, without an office, and without an appendix. But you know, he was incredibly resilient because he knew, he knew that he had a destiny. And that might be what Joseph was like, you know? The people who, if you read the biography of anybody who really, Lincoln also, by the way, suffered from depression. Interesting. If you read the biography of anybody who is great, as opposed to, you know, a celebrity or successful, but to anybody who proves to be great, they invariably, there are several periods in their life where they have failures and where, if you didn't know the end of the story and you just happen to know this guy, you think this guy's never, right, this guy's never going to make it. So. What's that?
Bipolar
is right. Yeah. You. Yes. Yeah.
When was the trope added? Because Hirsch's.
Right. Good question. The trope was added in. I mean, look. The Torah was chanted from ancient times, so it's hard to say when it was added. As it is now, the Masoretes in the 8th century, so a good 1,000 years before, before Hirsch, solidified the text and much of the trope. So. Hirsch's, but in Jewish commentary, it's considered authoritative. That is, you're allowed to drash from the trope, and we will later on in the Joseph story. There's an important drasha from the notes. Any final questions? Okay, one, two, and that'll do it. Yeah.
Was Joseph at fault for disturbing the Shalom Bayit? And if we fast forward, like, to Martin Luther King, is he at fault for verbalizing that I have a dream?
So the question was Joseph at fault for disturbing Shalom Bayit? Was Martin Luther King at fault for disturbing civil unrest? And the answer is, it's all dependent on context. Sometimes you have to disturb a society, right? As I think we would all agree that King had to. And Joseph had to for the realization of the design, but you can still judge him well or badly. A better example in some ways is John Brown. Okay, John Brown was the great American abolitionist, but he killed people along the way at Harper's Ferry. So even people who supported abolition felt John Brown had gone too far, but other people feel like the country was so sunk in sin that you needed someone to do something dramatic and even horrendous in order to wake up the nation. And it's hard to make, how do you make the determination of such things, you know? Was it okay for Menachem Begin and the Irgun to blow up the King David Hotel? Well, you know, you're gonna get more than one opinion about that. Because even though, yes, they warned people and they told them to get out, the truth is innocent people were killed. So I can't answer that question it's too complicated to answer simply, but I will tell you, Thoreau, who was the author of the essay on civil disobedience that profoundly influenced both Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And if you've never read Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, if you want to understand the history of protests, it's something to do. When Thoreau was put in jail for not paying taxes because of the Mexican-American War, and Emerson went to see him and said, "Is there anything I can do for you?" Thoreau said, "Yes, you can get in here with me." Yeah. Okay, this is a nice attempt to exonerate Joseph. I mean, maybe right. I don't mean by a nice attempt that is, Joseph was a dream interpreter. That was his nature. We see that later on. And And he could have understood his own dreams, but instead he humbly comes to his brothers and to his brothers and to his father and asks them for the interpretation of the dream rather than saying himself. Tzadik Ozer Hashem Mekayem is a statement from the Talmud that the tzadik says something and then God fulfills it. I hate to be a prosecuting attorney against Joseph. The only thing I would say is, though, after having that interpretation would work for the first time. It's hard to understand, though, why he would do it again if he saw that the brothers resented the first dream. Because if you come to someone humbly and ask them something and they get angry at you, and then you come again and ask them pretty much the same thing again, that shows a certain resistance to their reaction.
But it's not written that they show it out.
Yeah, it is.
Outside,
by sale. No. His brother said, "Do you mean to rule over us?" That's what they say.
But you give it that tone. It could be another tone there. They could be asking it.
Hey, Joseph. Hey, gonna rule over us? What do you say, buddy? Okay. Conceivably, although the fact I'm reading the tone from the emotion that's then given to us. I'm reading the tone from the fact that they hated him. So you're right. Look. It's possible to assume that Joseph came humbly and they answered evenly. It is certainly possible to assume that. The way I think I read it is more plausible, but it's not the only reading. Fair enough. Right, exactly. All right, and on that beautiful note that there are 70 faces to the Torah, that no one reading exhausts it, we'll see you after the new year. Thank you.